the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mark Elliott is my guest this week, the author of dozens of books on American popular culture, including biographies of Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, and an actor named Ronald Reagan. Mark Elliott has also been the co-author of a few autobiographies, including that of James Brown. Mark Elliott has also written about rock and roll music in books about Bruce Springsteen and the Eagles. His latest subject is the remarkable career of Clint Eastwood. The book is American Rebel, The Life of Clint Eastwood. Mark Elliott, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, well, a pleasure to be here.
You know, one of the interesting things about the age of the Internet is the ability to know what everyone thinks about your work.
Yeah.
And no one is ever so about a Mark Elliott book. I mean, Amazon ratings are almost always 5 stars or 1 angry star.
I have noticed that.
Do you consciously set out to write a controversial study of your subjects?
Well, I don't set out to be controversial. I don't think anybody who approaches these subjects the way I do tries to be controversial, but you know there's controversy and there's controversy. My mentor at Columbia University was Andrew Saras, and Andrew Saras, of course, the originator of the American version of auteurism. And to know Andrew Saras is to know a very gentle, thoughtful, cerebral man with strong opinions about films, obviously. Well, I've never seen anybody go through what he goes through when people disagree with what he says, or even the entire theory. So his level of controversy is probably closer to what happens when I write. The Internet allows everybody to be a critic, and that's not so bad for people to express themselves. I mean, I think that's what we're all about. But sometimes where people come from when they're criticizing work of mine is fascinating to me. I don't pay too much attention to it other than the fact that it's there and I read it and I want to know what people think. But, you know, my email is on my website, and those letters are either you're the greatest writer who ever lived, or don't look behind you tomorrow, we'll get you. I think it's just the nature of the beast, the beast being me, I guess. And, I think if you don't arouse emotions of people when you write about subjects that everybody believes he or she already knows about, they're probably not doing your job the way it should be done. I know when I wrote my Walt Disney book, for example, mm-hmm. The family is still railing about that book in the New York Times, in this publication, and that one. And yet, in all the years that has gone by, there was never a lawsuit. There was never any legal action. It was just that they didn't like what I wrote, is what it came down to, and. You know, you have to have a thick skin when you're writing about people's lives. And, you know, I think I have that, but it was a long time in coming. So, yeah, I try to write the truth. I try to do a lot of interpretation. I try to do a lot of research. And my feeling is if there's nothing new to write about, then why are you doing it?
Why bother writing the book? Well,
yeah.
You know, since you mentioned the Disney book, let's just chat about that for a moment.
Yeah.
I think the key is when you say interpretation. I mean, I think if you could take anybody's life, except for mine, and examine it and make it look one way or another, mine could only look marvelous. But, you know, the title, Hollywood's Dark Prince, definitely lets us know, you know, that you have a different view of Disney than those of us who, you know, watched Uncle Walt on our TV, you know, when we were kids, which I'm sure includes you, too.
Was the whole point, I think.
Right.
Was that my view. You know, when let me just tell you something very quickly.
Sure.
Because a lot of people really don't know this who are familiar with that book. When I signed that book up I think it was Simon & Schuster, I had the intention of writing a beautiful book about a wonderful man. I said, who better to write about, to break into the bigger mainstream world of biography, than somebody who was such a hero. I said, here's a fellow where I cannot go wrong. And of course, everything that I wound up discovering came after the fact. So, you know, people tend to think, well, you had an agenda with that book. There was no agenda. It took almost 2 years, I think, looking back now, to get that FBI file. And all the controversy that came out of it came from the file, not from whole cloth. And, you know, I decided to go with that. I interviewed people for that book who had never been interviewed for any Walt Disney book, who were crucial to the studio and to the story. And most of those interviews I did were not only the only, but the last interview of all the people involved, animators, people who worked at the studio and in other positions. And if I had not done that book and interviewed those people, that story would never have been told. And my answer back then when that book came out was, look, there were 30 books about Walt Disney out there that think he's, you know, Davy Crockett incarnate. I think there's room for one that has a slightly different opinion. And that kind of carries through through every book, really. I try to find something that means something to me, and that's why I write about them. And as Andrew Saris talks about, when everybody thinks one way, it's almost your responsibility as a critic, as an historian, and as a biographer to look a different way, to deepen the story.
Well, when I read your biography of Phil Oakes, Death of a Rebel, in 1979, I really felt that book, which I guess was also controversial, was a very personal book, that you knew Phil Oakes and that his music had meant a lot to you, and for that reason you were sort of driven to write about him. Was that the case?
Well, that's absolutely right. I not only knew him, but I wrote about him before he died. I wrote several pieces, an interview with him I did, a piece that appeared in The Age of Rock, this book that Random House had put out, a compilation of kind of offbeat pieces. So I always intended to write about Phil. Phil was a great influence on my life and on my writing, and I kind of looked to him the way the boy in Almost Famous looks at that rock band. And our relationship had a little bit of that in it. But we came to be very good friends. And I had finished all my PhD work at Columbia University's film school, actually the School of the Arts. And I really intended to teach film the rest of my life. When Phil died, I went to the family and I said, look, Phil's family, you know, I want to write this book before somebody comes along and writes some fairy tale. And at the time, everybody said, great, that's a great idea, go ahead and try to write it. And I did. It took 2 years of my life, but I talked to over 200 people to write that book. And the reason it was called Death of a Rebel and not Life of a Rebel was because of how I saw what had happened to him and what was essentially wrong with him from the very beginning. A lot of people don't like it because they don't like the message, and they sometimes they want to just kill the messenger. But the book stayed in print for 20 years. There were numerous film deals attached to it, and I'm very proud of that book. It was the first major publication of my life, and funnily enough, earlier today, I was interviewed by a British publication where I spent almost 2 hours talking to them about Phil Oakes. So for better or for worse, that book stands as really the stylistic announcement of what I do, who I am as a writer.
It's a marvelous book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
So how did that, after having, you know, sort of accomplished that goal of writing that book about Phil, how did that lead you to the career that you've had, writing about movies as well as music?
Well, funny thing is, I had no agent and no editor when I wrote that book. It was a literal case of over the transom. I sent out the first chapter to 30 publishers in New York. There used to be a book published every year called how to get a book published. And the reason people bought it was only because in the back they listed the names and addresses of editors and publishers in New York City. So I, like everyone else, sent that out, and to make a long story short, by some miracle, Doubleday bought it for Anchor Press, and it was the first what they call quality paperback ever published. It was for the Anchor Doubleday imprint.
It was nobody really bought much. It was a $5 book.
That's right. Mm. They didn't pay much more than that for it. and I worked on it. I worked at other jobs at that time to subsidize that book. When it came out, the New York Times Sunday Book Review gave it a half-page review, and the next day I walked into the publisher. In those days, when you were a first book writer, you wind up going to the publisher every day, and people kind of turn their heads away. No, not him again, because you have nothing else to do. So you go up there and you talk to people. This day, when the review was coming out, they found out in those days on a Thursday before the Sunday book review. I walked in that Thursday, and everybody looked at me kind of funny, and I knew something was up. I thought probably not so good. Then I got called into the editor-in-chief's office, and she said, "Well, New York Times has reviewed Death of a Rebel. They liked it, and you've got a career. What do you want to do next?" And that's essentially what happened. I never went back to write my thesis, although I think some of the work that I've done could stand as strongly as any Hollywood-related thesis or film-related thesis. And I worked for a while. I had I did three or four books that were very forgettable. I kind of lost my way a little bit. I had a four-year writer's block where I lived in Virginia and worked as a writer in residence, not doing too much at a college. And then Rockonomics in 1989 was this flash I had about Buddy Holly, really, is what kicked that book off. And I kind of had this realization that rock and roll was, if you want to know the history of rock and roll, the way to do it was not to follow the myth, but follow the money, and that will give you the best history possible. That book, again, nobody thought anything of it too much, except everybody noticed it and everybody bought it. That spun off into another major reprinting in hardback of Death of a Rebel, and before I knew it, I got a call from a very, very big editor to ask me who I would like to write about. This time around, I said to myself, well, maybe avoid things like Phil Oakes and all of that, and do something really mainstream and pleasing. And so I came up with Walt Disney, somebody who I was always interested in anyway. and, of course, everybody knows, I guess, that became a front-page battle royal between the Disney family and me, followed by on the heels of that, and maybe I did Roy Clark's Life, which, looking back now, was one of the happier experiences of writing. I got involved in the O.J. Simpson murder trial. I was a witness for the prosecution, and because I didn't want to testify, they threatened to put me in jail for contempt of court.
Wait a minute. What did they want you to testify about? How were you a witness? What were you a witness to?
Well, Cato Kalin. If you remember him at all.
Sure, of course.
came to me wanting me to write his life story. And I said okay, and there was a ton of money thrown at us. Everybody was getting thrown tons of money in those days for those O.J. Connection books.
Sure.
And then I wrote it, and his lawyer had a lot of problems with it. I turned on the television to watch him testify, and nothing in the testimony matched what he had told me, and I had these 17 hours of recordings between him and me that told an entirely different story. And that story that I told in the book, his lawyer didn't want told. They had a very specific agenda. Make a long story here shorter. We split. I wrote my own book about partly about the facts that I knew them and partly how I got sucked into this trial. But I remember sitting, it was a state trial. It wasn't a federal trial. So I got out of town, came to New York City, had a very good lawyer, a friend of mine who agreed to help me on this. And he said, "Do you realize that O.J. Simpson killed his wife, and you're going to be the only guy who goes to jail for it?" on this, this contempt thing.
Why did you not want to testify?
Why did I not want to testify? I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because everybody who testified, I don't know if you're, how well you remember that case. There was a doctor who treated athletes for knee injuries.
Right.
There was a screenwriter in Georgia who was called up. Everybody went under character assassination from the other side, from the Dream Team,
right,
if they testified against O.J. And, you know, there was a lot there that they could dig up on me. My life was not a pristine life. And so I said, I really don't want to do that. I mean, that's not a good move for me. So I avoided it. We made deals. I gave them the tapes. I came out of it. And then I looked for, I said, well, I have to get back to music. I've got to get back to something I really enjoy and that I know I can about. So I did the Eagles, and of course that turned into another battle. So a book called To the Limit, which I'm very proud of. It's a wonderful book.
What did everybody hate about that one?
Well, the only person who hated it was Don Henley, because the book was too close to the mark. You know, I had written it. Galleys were about to be released, and the proofs for the industry, and I got a call from David Geffen saying, who I had tried to interview for the book and couldn't get to. Geffen called up and said, listen, I have one of these galleys of yours. And I said, really? How did you get that? Never mind how I got it, he said, and it's a really great book, because he and Henley hate each other. He said, except there's a few things you didn't get right, and I'm willing to spend some time with you to get it right. So I went back to the publisher of the book, Warner, and I said, look, if you're willing to let me make some changes at this late date, we can kick this book upstairs to a really better place. They said, fine. The next day, we all got letters from Don Henley's attorneys saying, well, if Geffen is going to talk to him, I want to talk to him. I mean, up until that point, Irving Azoff, the promoter and manager of the Eagles, had tried to block me from talking to everybody, which didn't work. Everybody wanted to talk about the Eagles. So I sat down with Don Henley and spent, I think, 2 weeks with him recording his version of things that happened. And after that, he said, oh, I want you to talk to this guy, I want you to talk to that guy. And it turned into what it turned into. To the Limit. But it was a very difficult battle, and also made the news when it came out, because Henley was so vocally against that book. So you had Walt Disney, Walt Disney, The Whole Truth, the Cato thing, and the Eagles in a row. And so throughout the 90s, I was more on the front page than I was on the book page, and it drove me a little bit crazy. So I decided to kick back, and I did. I worked with Barry White, whom I adored. I loved him, and that was a relatively calm book for me to do. And then I did a couple of others because I enjoyed doing them. The Donna Summer's Life, didn't particularly enjoy that experience, but I thought it was a good book. And I got a chance to write with James Brown, you know, childhood idol of mine. Turned out to be the last thing he ever did in his life. I also, by the way, got called on that trial to testify on the estate trial. So, you know, I kind of discovered it doesn't really matter if you know anything. If you're a body, they'll call you down and try to make a case through you. And then I decided that I wanted to swing back after so much time had passed with the Walt Disney book. I wanted to write about movies again, but in a better way, in a higher way than I had done before. And I was in, listen to this, I think you get a kick out of it. I was in Slovenia visiting some friends, and I was walking down this beautiful, beautiful village in old Europe. And I passed a haircutting store, you know, where the whole window is the whole store, and in it was a life-size portrait of Cary Grant. And I just looked at it, and I said, wow, Cary Grant, here in Slovenia, he's in the window of this small village in Eastern Europe. So from Slovenia, I called my agent, and I said, I want to write about Cary Grant. I think he's that great. And sure enough, Random House picked it up, and that led to Well, that, of course, made the best soloist and brought me back to film as a subject that I wanted to explore in more than one biography. I wanted to go from the 30s, really, through the 40s, 50s, 60s, right up to the present time, and do it through people who had changed the industry. Cary Grant certainly changed it, not just on screen, but because of how he restructured what actors could do contractually with studios.
Right.
He was the first freelance actor to successfully work without the confines of a studio. And then I did Jimmy Stewart, who I thought was crucial to the post-war transitional age of Hollywood, where he comes out of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the height of that, and then comes back with really Hitchcock and Anthony Mann after the war. I thought that was a beautiful way to look at how the war affected Hollywood and the biggest names, what happened to them. And then, of course, writing about Jimmy Stewart and Hitchcock was a joy. And then after that, I did Ronald Reagan's Hollywood career. And the reason I wanted to do Reagan was not so much because of what happened later, but his work with the Screen Actors Guild was so fascinating to me that I thought that that would fill in part of this revisionist history that I was writing. And then to take it to the next step in this ongoing revisionism, I wanted to write about Clint Eastwood. That kind of brings you more or less to the present of what I have published in terms of film.
Well, we're talking with Mark Elliott, and the book that we're just beginning to talk about here is American Rebel, The Life of Clint Eastwood, and it's an excellent book. I think the most interesting aspect of Clint Eastwood, which I think is sort of like Ronald Reagan in reverse, is that Eastwood was kind of a right-wing sort of character. You mentioned in the Academy Award presentation when Marlon Brando gave his Oscar to Sasheen Littlefeather, and Clint said, well, maybe we should dedicate this next award to all the cowboys that got shot by all the Indians and all the John Ford. And now he's kind of a more of a left-wing sort of a fellow in terms of making films about euthanasia and tolerance in Gran Torino, for instance.
Well, it's an interesting point that you make, and I think it's a good one, that Reagan, the more he developed and really rose in society is what it was, the more conservative he got, mostly because of his second marriage to Nancy, whose goal in life was to elevate the Reagans to the creme de la creme of the Hollywood society. And then, of course, the Real Estate Society in California. And that's what really helped shift Reagan. In terms of Eastwood, the difference is that Eastwood is a filmmaker and that Reagan was more or less an actor for hire, for whom the action was in the guilds and the unions and later on as a corporate spokesman for GE prior to his entry into California state politics and eventually the presidency. With Eastwood had the luxury of making the films that he was in after Hang 'em High, when he created Malpaso, his own film company. So he called all the shots. And what's fascinating to watch these films is that you see a theme in them very clearly. And that theme, as I talked about, you know, in American Rebel, is that of the loner, but not the loner in a romantic way, where at the end he rides into the cemetery like Shane, but a loner who can get along quite well without not just women but anybody. What's striking about that is it's very difficult in America to make a hit movie where there isn't a big female co-star. Clint never had that. Clint always worked essentially as a reflection of his own view and vision of film as an art and film as a business. Because he did that, he was able to extend his career far longer than most male hunks or he-men. You know, people think that Steve McQueen, for example, is the anticipation of Clint Eastwood. Really, Steve McQueen comes after Clint Eastwood, but because of his early death and because he didn't have the kind of control that Clint Eastwood had, by the time Steve McQueen made The Sand Pebbles, he was finished. He was kind of burned out. He did the Burning and Towering Inferno and then some weird movies at the end, but he was finished because he was an aging male ingenue. It's really what Clint Eastwood was, Steve McQueen was. Clint Eastwood, because he didn't have that aspect, that sexual romantic aspect, was able to grow gracefully. And if you look at all these films, the ones that you're mentioning, let's jump right to Gran Torino. That's a film that is really, in many ways, a remake or an extension of the character of the man with no name, Dirty Harry, men who lived alone, who had no significant women in their lives on screen. Dirty Harry's wife is dead when the film begins. In Gran Torino, that fellow is dead. The children say, that fellow's wife is dead. The children say, come and live with me. No, no, no. I want to live by myself. The neighbors are annoying to him. The only thing that appeals to him in that film is this sense of street justice, which is pure Man with No Name and pure Dirty Harry. What he comes to realize in that film when he develops this attachment to the Hmongs is he finds an expiation for his guilt for what he did in Korea. And that speaks not to any romantic image, but to a recognition of his own, you could almost say, love of violence. And so Gran Torino becomes a highly personal film that is immediately recognizable in the line of Clint Eastwood's films in his career. You know, François Truffaut said that the reason his generation in France, a post-war generation, was so able to analyze film so acutely and to understand the character of a director like John Ford, like Alfred Hitchcock, and like so many Howard Hawks, is because there were no films available to be seen in France during World War II. The film industry ceased to exist, especially foreign films. You couldn't get them in, you couldn't get them out. So after the war, instead of seeing a film by, say, John Ford, one film a year, and kind of forgetting the previous one and then seeing the new one, they were able to watch 10 John Ford films, 10 Howard Hawks films, 10 Hitchcock films. And by doing that, they began to formulate this notion that there is a through line of art in so-called auteurist filmmaking. And what you learn about Clint Eastwood, I think, is that there's a very specific artistic statement being made in his films, of which Gran Torino is a kind of the not to make a pun, the Grand Guignol of that look, coated over with a sense of mortality that creeps into that film. And I think for that reason, when you can tell where a film fits in a filmmaker's career, that's a major filmmaker.
It's a fascinating book, and it's called American Rebel: The Life of Clint Eastwood, and the author, and it's been really a pleasure having you on the show today, is Mark Elliott. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next time for another great show. I want to thank Mark Elliott, the author of American Rebel, The Life of Clint Eastwood, for that career-spanning interview today. And I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Be sure to check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes or Facebook. We'll see you next time.